Hello and welcome to Ape Stench's Audio Cave. I am your host, Ape Stench, and the purpose of this podcast is simply to relive that long forgotten genre of recording, the documentary / spoken word / educational album. Over the coming weeks, I'm going to be sharing with you some of my collection of documentary vinyl. Starting today, with one of my favorite albums that I have in my collection. This one is called A Time to Keep, 1963. This was an album put out by RCA Victor in 1964 to recount the events of the year 1963. It is narrated by Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, who were famous for the Huntley-Brinkley Report back at that time on NBC. In this album, they narrate many of the top news stories of the year 1963, so you'll be hearing actual voices, actual recordings of the top news stories of 1963, starting with the civil rights movement, going through normal everyday affairs such as the World Series, and ending, of course, with the top event of 1963, the assassination of President Kennedy. You'll be hearing many of the actual news reports and actual voices as they happened, narrated by the newsmen Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, and I hope you enjoy this.
There is an appointed time for everything, and a time for every affair under the heavens. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to uproot the plant. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away.
A time to keep. The words are from the third chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes, and they're old beyond the tracing. But in the year 1963, on a solemn November Monday, they would be summoned back. There is an appointed time for everything under the sun. And for all of us, for the young and old, whatever our station or our goals, 1963 was a year to remember. A time to keep.
When it began, there was the usual rattling and thumping of ordinary things happening in ordinary ways. On New Year's Day, Southern California beat Wisconsin 42-37, which was nice for Southern California, but not terribly startling. On January 2nd, Fidel Castro gave us another exercise in the modern art form, talk fact. That is, say something is a fact because you wish it were. He said the imperialists, meaning us, of course, had been defeated all over Latin America. So not much was new. But soon we heard something that was a new voice, one many Americans did not want to hear, but it could not be escaped. It was the voice of the American Negro demanding a better deal. The Negro was no longer somewhere on the other side of town. He was at the front door and tired of knocking.
We've waited 100 years! And we are not waiting another day. We want all of it now! We want every privilege. We want every benefit. We want every right. We want every opportunity. And we want it now!
We want it now. It was a phrase we would hear again and again in 1963. Now. Now, as though all their yesterdays were debts long overdue, and tomorrow would be too late.
The Negro tide rose like the rising of a tide on a beach, quietly and subtly in some places, noisily and violently in others. Birmingham, Alabama was one of these. It began on April 2nd, a giant complaint about segregation at lunch counters, public facilities, and in jobs. Within 3 weeks, more than 400 Negroes had been arrested, water hoses had been used against them, and dogs, but the demonstrators were aroused and would not be stopped.
The spark that was struck in Birmingham crackled like a brush fire across the South.
And what began in the South then spread northward to the big cities of the East and Midwest. Pickets held up construction work in New York until promises were made that more Negroes would be hired. Chicago heard them demanding better schools and housing. By midsummer, we knew this was not just another protest, but a revolution. A curious revolution, and curious because it was reluctant and restrained. There were violent moments, but mainly its philosophy was taken from the Negro Protestant Church, and what in other countries and at other times would have been a call to bloodshed became, in this case, a sermon. This is Cambridge, Maryland, summer 1963.
In the midst of moral injustices, yes. Lord, help us to say, Lord, thy will be done.
Amen.
And help us to love as we never loved before. Lord, as we walk in thy will, hear us from on high.
Yes,
stir up the city of Cambridge.
Yes.
And put thy love in the hearts of our white brothers and sisters.
Jackson, Mississippi, and Albany, Georgia, Baltimore, Nashville rally. On June 11th, two Negro students were enrolled at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, Vivian Juanita Malone and James Alexander Hood. Both were 20. Alabama's Governor George C. Wallace made his promised gesture of defiance, standing in the schoolhouse door as the nation watched on television, and the two students appeared for their enrollment. While an official of the Justice Department fidgeted uneasily, Wallace read his legal pronouncement.
Now, therefore, I, George C. Wallace, as governor of the state of Alabama, have by my action raised issues between the central government and the sovereign state of Alabama, which said issues should be adjudicated in the manner prescribed by the Constitution of the United States, and now being mindful of my duties and responsibilities under the Constitution of the United States.
June 11th, and the day ended as it began, with legalistic words being read in a legalistic way, and a boy and a girl giving stereotyped answers to stereotyped questions, and a deputy attorney general who seemed slightly embarrassed by what he was doing. Well, somehow it seemed unreal, but it was terribly real. Midnight came, and with it, a quietness on the campus at Tuscaloosa. But at that moment, 180 miles to the southwest, across the Mississippi state line in Jackson, Medgar Evers, a field director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, drove home from an integration rally. He was 37, a college graduate, married, father of two sons and a daughter. He stepped out of his car. He was shot and killed. Now, there was more to come. Birmingham again. On the morning of September 15th, a Sunday, the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed. Four Negro girls, listening to a Sunday school lesson, were killed. The lesson was called The Love That Forgives.
Newsmen walking the streets of Birmingham noted a tenseness, a strange self-consciousness between the whites and Negroes. Some wrote phrases like fear gripping the city. There were such moments, of course, in Birmingham and in other cities and towns. But what is more significant is that in most places there was neither the fear nor the compulsion toward violence that most revolutions feed on. In fact, in many places, north and south, changes did come subtly and silently. Not everything the Negroes had demanded, but some, and it was now.
What are we marching for? How long are we going to march?
All right.
If there is a sound that was characteristic of that year, it would be the sound of footsteps, of thousands of men and women and children walking on endless errands. Walking not to move from one place to another, but to be seen, to be heard, to have their desires made manifest and public. And in the heat of summer, in August, that angry month when the French Revolution snarled and burned its way through Paris streets, there was a new and exultant chapter written in the history of Western thought.
It began early in the morning of Wednesday, August 28th. More than 200,000 people, mostly Negroes, but many whites, gathered on the long slope below the Washington Monument in the nation's capital. They carried signs saying, "An end to bias, decent housing, an end to police brutality," and each of them punctuated with the word, "Now." Some of the leaders met with members of Congress and the president, but it was the ordinary people who gave the day its strange power and dignity. Slowly, quietly, the huge crowd walked a mile to the Lincoln Memorial. The police were there, plus National Guardsmen and Army reservists, 5,000 in all, and the Army was ready nearby, but the marchers caused less trouble than a crowd leaving a night ball game. The ceremonies at the memorial were, in a sense, almost anticlimactic. The Reverend Martin Luther King aroused the crowd with words that all of them wanted said.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual.
Dr. King's words really were aimed across town at Capitol Hill. There, 2 months earlier, the president had delivered a civil rights bill to Congress. As he did, he spelled out, as no other president ever had, exactly what the issue was.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? Legislation, I repeat, cannot solve this problem alone. It must be solved in the homes of every American, in every community across our country.
But even when some things change, most things don't. And 1963, in most ways, was like any other year. Somewhere, a panel of middle-aged judges chose a beauty queen, put a rhinestone crown on her head, and she burst into tears and embraced the girl who came in second. Several politicians claimed they were misquoted, that they didn't really say that, but they did. Somewhere, a little boy got his head caught in something, and the fire department got it out. And surely, somewhere, the newspapers reported a man named Washington was caught telling a lie in traffic court. The quintuplets were in this year. There were two sets. 5 boys in Venezuela. Their mother was 34 and already a grandmother. A week later, another set in Aberdeen, South Dakota, born to Mrs. Mary Ann Fisher. The Census Bureau said, at 20 seconds after 10:59 in the morning of September 27th, Eastern Daylight Time, the population of the United States hit 190 million, including the Fisher quintuplets.
And of those 190 million, 55,912 crowded into Los Angeles Chavez Ravine on the afternoon of October 6th to watch the home team meet the New York Yankees in the 4th game of the World Series. The Dodgers had taken the first 3 games, with 2 away in the last half of the 9th. Dodgers leading 2-1, Koufax pitching. There was one more tense moment.
Elston Howard, the batter, with 2 out of the 9th inning. He swings a ground ball to deep shortstop. Mari Wills throws the second. It's all. Wait a minute. He dropped the ball. He had it. Called him out. And then the ball was dropped. Howard is safe at first base. Bobby Richardson is safe at second. And now it's all between Koufax and Hector Lopez. It's a tap back past the mound to Mari Wills. He grabs it, throw to first. It's all over the Dodgers winning. The final score, the Dodgers 2 and the Yankees 1. Well, the Los Angeles Dodgers are the world's champions of baseball as they have swept the 1963 World Series in four straight games.
Nobody counted, but there did seem to be a few more beards being worn than there had been in past years, and they were perhaps a little more neatly trimmed than in 62. The pizza became upper middle class and fashionable. The stock market was generally up and steady. Necklines were down and unsteady.
It was also a year of sudden and violent deaths. Disaster is no stranger to the pages of history. But in 1963, it seemed to strike with more viciousness and versatility than usual. On April 10th, in the waters of the Atlantic, 220 miles east of Cape Cod, the USS Thresher, a nuclear-powered submarine, failed the surface after a dive. 129 officers, men, and civilian technicians perished. And in the early morning of July 26th, the city of Skopje in Yugoslavia was shaken by the first tremors of a devastating earthquake. When it was over, some 2,000 persons had been killed. On October 4th, a hurricane went wild in the Caribbean for 4 days and left at least 6,000 dead in Haiti and Cuba. A dam spilled over above the Italian alpine town of Longroni, wiping out 1,800 persons, 80% of the population. And on August 13th, a coal mine accident near Hazleton, Pennsylvania, trapped three men 300 feet underground. Two of the men were saved in a dramatic 14-day rescue operation that caught the attention of the world. Our microphone was present when miner Henry Throne was hoisted to the surface.
All right, I'm coming up.
Go ahead, he's coming up.
All right.
Go ahead.
I'm coming up.
He's coming up.
I'm turning around the ring. Boy, what a ride this is.
You're right here, boy. Nothing but the best for you.
They have him. Henry Throne has reached the surface.
On March 22nd, John Profumo of the British Cabinet stood up in the House of Commons, looked out over the benches filled with his colleagues, and told a lie. He said, yes, he knew a girl named Christine Keeler, but only in a proper way. But the rumors ran on and on. There were stories of racy happenings beside the pool on Lord Astor's estate, and other encounters which placed Profumo, the State Secretary for War, in the same fast crowd or set with a Captain Ivanov of the Soviet Embassy and a Dr. Stephen Ward, an osteopath who always seemed to have young girls around. Well, on the 4th of June, Profumo admitted it was all a lie. His previous denial was, as he put it, not true, and I misled you, the Prime Minister, and my colleagues in the House. I have come to realize that by this deception I have been guilty of a grave misdemeanor. Now, there were calls for Macmillan to resign. He didn't want to, and for a long time, he didn't. But in October, he went to a hospital for surgery, and then he announced, I will need a considerable period of convalescence. I would not be able to face a prolonged electoral campaign. The Earl of Hume, Foreign Secretary in the Macmillan Cabinet, renounced his peerage and became Prime Minister Sir Alec Douglas Hume, and so ended the affair Profumo. Nell Gwynn and a host of other ladies who, throughout history, were involved in activities that were sometimes at least quasi-political, simply would not have understood.
And sometimes dramatically, sometimes subtly, the familiar world was changing. On October 15th, 5 days after Macmillan quit, West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, now 87, finally kept his long-delayed promise to resign his leadership. In a statement to the Bundestag, Der Alte made it clear that though he had stepped down, he had not stepped out.
Und meine verehrten Damen und Herren, ich werde zuhören.
Now I will return to your ranks and I will listen. I hope to speak but little.
Dann werde ich Herrn Wendtimich auffordern. Dann werde ich sprechen, hoffentlich gut sprechen.
But if you ask me, then I will speak.
Only Charles de Gaulle, France's implacable man of destiny and dreams, remained at year's end of the big three leaders of Western Europe. And de Gaulle, early in 1963, made it clear he intended, if necessary, to go it alone after squeezing Britain out of the common market and turning down a United States offer of Polaris submarines.
Économique européenne et aussi dans celle de l'adhésion éventuelle de la Grande-Bretagne. Ce sont les faits qu'il faut d'abord considérer.
In South Vietnam, already strained by a war against communist guerrillas and tense with religious and political discontent, a final convulsion. In a series of swift moves on November 1st and 2nd, the United States trained and equipped South Vietnamese armed forces, toppled the government, and deposed President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother and chief advisor Ngo Dinh Nu, chief of the country's secret police.
In Vietnam, it is this. No coup can be, can erupt without at least American incitement or American...
Madame Nu was in this country when it happened. Lovely and chic and bitter in her resentment against Americans, she spit out her answers to the newsmen who surrounded her.
Shows that there is a real lack of control or disloyalty from the American government. Lack of control or disloyalty.
Will you seek political asylum in this country if the coup is successful?
Never. No, because I cannot stay in the country.
On the first day of this year, at the traditional New Year's Day party in the Kremlin, a rumor finally became a reality, or at least got official recognition. Premier Khrushchev acknowledged that there were some differences between Russia and China, but they were, he said, of a family nature. Later, Radio Moscow was not so subtle.
China's leaders say they favor peace and peaceful coexistence. Unfortunately, their actions do not bear this out. And actions speak louder than words. During the Caribbean crisis, when the world stood on the brink of a thermonuclear disaster, China's leaders tried to fan the flames by claiming that a compromise with the United States amounted to surrendering to imperialism and reaching a Munich deal at the expense of the Cuban nation. It is significant that any move to improve relations between the Soviet Union and the United States meets with strong objections from the Chinese leaders.
And a response from Radio Pekin.
In the present situation of the international communist movement, it is advantageous from the point of view of tactics to refer to the desire for peaceful transition. But it would be inappropriate to overemphasize the possibility of peaceful transition. The proletariat and the Communist Party must be prepared at all times to repulse counter-revolutionary attacks. And at the critical juncture of the revolution, when the working class is seizing state power, to overthrow the bourgeoisie by armed force if it uses armed force to suppress the people's revolution.
On August 5th, in Moscow, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union agreed to a treaty outlawing nuclear testing in outer space, in the atmosphere, and underwater. On September 24th, the United States Senate ratified it. And by early September, there was a direct teletype circuit called a hotline between the Kremlin and the White House for fast communication between the two centers of power. At the end of the year, it was announced West Berliners would be allowed to visit relatives in the communist sector of Germany. East German guards were photographed breaking a hole in the infamous wall for the Western visitors to walk through. It was a stirring moment in a city that has known many of them. On June 26, President Kennedy had visited West Berlin during a triumphant tour. In a confrontation with 150,000 ecstatic West Berliners, he summoned them to stand firm and meet their obligations to the future.
2,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus Sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
It was a strange meeting, this young man in this place. Before him were men who 19 years earlier had been shooting at Americans, and now they cheered the English words and waved American flags. And for a few moments, he stood there and listened to their voices. He would not come back.
Vor 2000 Jahren war der stolzeste Satz, den ein Mensch sagen konnte, der, ich bin ein Bürger Roms. Heute ist der stolzeste Satz, den jemand in der freien Welt sagen kann, ich bin ein Berliner.
Well, he had the knife and a gun on the table. I repeated some words he told me, but I only could explain what he meant. I could repeat the words, but they were in Sicilian.
They were what?
In Sicilian. You know, Sicilian.
This man's name is Joseph Valachi. He's 60 years old. There has been a certain untidiness in his affairs. In September of 1963, Senator John McClellan of Arkansas called Valachi from a prison cell to Washington after he had demonstrated a willingness that is rare in his circles, a willingness to talk shop. In his case, to talk about the Cosa Nostra, as he called it, our thing or our affair. He described, for example, the initiation into Cosa Nostra.
He gave me a piece of paper, I suppose, you know, and burned it. In other words, now this piece of paper. This
what?
Piece of paper is burned.
Paper is burned.
You light it.
Yes?
And then in your hand, you say, well, again, they give you words in Italian, but I know what it meant.
In other words, while you were repeating the words, you were burning
this,
the paper.
Right. This is the way I burn if I expose this organization.
His testimony was often imprecise or fuzzy, but it had a certain flair, and we heard phrases like the kiss of death and some splendid Runyon-esque names, Joe Bananas, Joe the Boss, Peter the Clutching Hand.
It was all very reminiscent of a similar investigation in 1950 and 51, when Senator Estes Kefauver questioned Frank Costello and others. Senator Kefauver was not present at Valachi's hearings. He had died of a heart attack on August 10th. And another face missing this year from the Senate, Robert Kerr of Oklahoma. He died on New Year's Day. And former Senator Tom Connally of Texas, actors Jack Carson and Dick Powell, both died on the same day, January 2nd. And inevitably, the list grew. Rogers Hornsby and Alec Templeton. Whitney A. Griswold, president of Yale. Author Van Wyck Brooks. Edith Piaf, the Sparrow of Paris Nightclubs, died on October 11th. And the same day, and almost as if in some gallant, sympathetic gesture, her friend, the poet and dramatist, Jean Cocteau.
In April and May, there were increasing rumors that Pope John the 23rd had a fatal illness. He died on June 3rd. Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli, the son of Italian peasant stock, was elected pope to succeed Pius XII in 1958. He was considered at the time an interim choice, but in the 4.5 years he reigned as head of the Roman Catholic Church, a warm human being became a most widely admired pope. There was his work in behalf of Christian unity, and perhaps above all, his calling together on October 11th, 1962, of the Ecumenical Council, the 21st in the long history of the Church. On June 21st, Giovanni Battista Cardinal Mantini, Archbishop of Milan since 1955, was elected to succeed John the 23rd. His coronation was the scene of ancient pageantry and ritual, and at the end of a long rite, he pronounced his first papal blessing.
Et benedictio Dei omnipotentis, Patris et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti descendat super vos, in manio semper.
Actor Adolphe Manjou died in late October. There was Richard Barthalmus, Monty Woolley, and before the year was quite a month old, Robert Frost. There's no official American poet laureate, but if there were, it would have been he. 4 times Pulitzer Prize winner, his poetry was simple and stark like the New Hampshire winters he knew so well. Vagrant sentences from his verse come back. Whose woods these are, I think I know. Something there is that doesn't love a wall. And a gentle, gracious little verse that reminds us all of the long roads that all of us must take. These woods are lovely, dark, and deep. But I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep.
2, 1, ignition, liftoff.
It was May 15th. Air Force Major Leroy Gordon Cooper riding the Faith 7 capsule into an orbit that took him at apogee to an altitude of 165 and 8 tenths miles above the Earth. All that day and the next, through 22 orbits, Gordon Cooper spun around the globe in the 6th and final flight of an American Mercury space vehicle, every one a success. But this flight had some anxious moments, just prior to re-entry when part of the automatic flight system had trouble. Listen as Cooper and astronaut John Glenn, aboard a ship in the Pacific, worked out plans for Cooper to fly his spaceship manually back to Earth.
That's the way, boy. I'll be
hearing
now. See
the retros on manual, and I'll
be in
the flight.
All right,
Roger,
okay.
I'm looking for lots of experience on this flight.
Hey, you're going to get it.
Okay, the next 10-second
count will be a countdown to your manual retro, over. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, retro fire.
Roger, a green one here. How'd your
autumn over the land and chill nights, and the year was old. Already there was talk of 64 and next summer's political conventions. The Democrats had their candidate, but the Republican convention was anybody's race. Rockefeller, George Romney of Michigan, William Scranton of Pennsylvania, and the name one heard most frequently was handsome, articulate, and above all, conservative Barry Goldwater of Arizona. At a news conference in Washington, Goldwater's name came up. The president's response was swift and sure and frankly partisan.
As I've said before, I think it would be unwise at this time to answer or reply to Senator Goldwater. I'm confident that he'll be making many charges, even more serious than this one, in the coming months. And in addition, he himself has had a busy week selling TVA and giving permission to suggesting that military commanders overseas be permitted to use nuclear weapons, attacking the president of Bolivia while he was here in the United States, involving himself in the Greek election. So I thought that it really would be not fair for me this week to reply to him.
But it was the president himself for whom the days were most crowded. Speeches in Florida, at San Antonio, Texas, at Houston, Fort Worth, and then, on Friday, November 22nd, a quick flight to Dallas.
There were 5,000 people waiting at the Dallas airport. The president, wearing a dark suit, stepped out of the plane, smiling. It was warm, 78 degrees. There was a brief reception. A committee gave Mrs. Kennedy a bouquet of red roses. 13 minutes after they landed, the president and his wife stepped into the big presidential limousine and began the ride into Dallas. With them, on jump seats, were Texas Governor John Connally and his wife, Nellie. The bubble top was down.
Several times during the ride, the president stood up in the back of the car to acknowledge the cheers of the crowd.
The car rolled at 25 miles an hour to a long curve that pointed toward a triple underpass on the fringe of downtown Dallas. Mrs. Connally turned toward the president and said, "Well, you can't say Dallas isn't friendly today." It was 12:30, Dallas time.
This is an NBC News bulletin. Shots were fired near President Kennedy in Dallas. Here is a report from Robert McNeil, NBC News, with the presidential party in Dallas.
Several shots were fired as President Kennedy's motorcade passed through downtown Dallas. Crowds screamed and lay down on the grass. As the motorcade went by, police broke away and began chasing an unknown gunman across some railroad tracks. It was not known if the shots were aimed at the president. Repeat, it is not known if the shots were aimed at the president. This is Robert McNeil, NBC News, in Dallas, Texas.
And here is a flash from the Associated Press in Dallas. The Associated Press reports that the president was seriously wounded. This is not confirmed. This is a flash. Repeat, this is a flash from the Associated Press in Dallas. They report that the president was seriously wounded by an assassin's bullets.
Information is still sketchy at this time. We have just talked with two eyewitnesses, a man and his wife, who were standing near the president's motorcade. They said that a shot rang out from behind them. They thought at first it was a firecracker. Then, according to the eyewitnesses, one woman who was in a hysterical condition told us that the president was hit in the side of the head and fell into his wife Jacqueline's arms. People screamed and lay down in the grass as the shots were heard as the motorcade went by. Police immediately fanned out over a wide area. A small Negro boy and a white man said they had seen a man with a gun in the window of a building overlooking the road.
Representative Albert Thomas, Democrat of Texas, says he's been informed the president and Governor Connally were both still alive. A Secret Service agent, Clint Hill, said he's dead. As the president,
Mrs. Kennedy, who was sitting beside him in the open car, was not hurt, but the governor of Texas, John Connally, was also reported wounded.
As the president has been given blood transfusions in an attempt to save his life. Two Roman Catholic priests. It was days before the facts of these few moments were finally pieced together. Just moments ago, there were three shots fired rapidly. The first struck the president in the back and might not have been fatal. The second shot struck Governor Connally as he turned to look. And the third, fired 5 seconds after the first, pierced president's head. For a few seconds, the car slowed, then roared at 70 miles an hour to Parkland Memorial Hospital, Mrs. Kennedy cradling her husband's limp body in her lap. The first physician to examine the president at the hospital knew it was too late.
Here is a flash from Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds suffered in the assassination attempt today. I will repeat with the greatest regret this flash. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he has died of bullet wounds.
The news came to each at his own place, and each responded in his own way. In New York City, at Fifth Avenue and 47th Street, a blind beggar with a transistor radio was surrounded by a crowd of shoppers who ignored his tapping cane to listen to his radio. Housewives, alone, listened and wept alone. Children in school were called to unscheduled assemblies and told the news. In Boston, an audience gathered to hear a concert by the Boston Symphony Orchestra heard this from the conductor, Eric Leinsdorf.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the virus. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination. We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
The president's body was placed back on the airplane that had brought him to Dallas. Vice President Johnson, his wife, and a still blood-spattered Jacqueline Kennedy stood in the plane while Mr. Johnson took the oath that made him president. Then his first executive order, let's get this airplane back to Washington. It was dusk when the airplane landed at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington. First, the coffin was lifted off. Mrs. Kennedy walked by its side. Then the new president emerged. The world was watching and waiting for his words. They were brief.
This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be waived. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know that the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help. and God's.
The coffin with the late president's body was taken to the Naval Hospital, and it was dark, and the day was over. In the early morning hours, Mrs. Kennedy took her husband's body back to the White House.
A suspect had been caught. His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. He was 24, a one-time Marine who had defected to the Soviet Union, married a Russian girl, and returned to this country to announce himself as the leader of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Well, that day, he'd gone to his job at the Texas Schoolbook Depository, a warehouse with windows overlooking the president's route. After the shooting, he had run out of the building, but he had been seen, and a description went out. A Dallas policeman, J.D. Tippett, spotted a man who fit the description. Tippett was shot. He died in the street 4 miles from the scene of the president's shooting. A few moments later, just before the president's death was announced, Oswald was caught in a theater and subdued. Later, newsmen asked him, "Did you shoot the president?"
"I didn't shoot anybody, sir. I haven't been told what I'm here for.
You have a lawyer?"
"No, sir, I don't."
On Saturday, the leaders of the nation paid their respects privately to the late president at the White House, arriving in a stately procession throughout a bleak, rainy day. On Sunday, just as the first public ceremonies in Washington were about to begin, an incredible drama unfolded in Dallas. Lee Oswald was being transferred from his cell in city jail to the county prison. It happened fast.
There is Lee Oswald.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. How did you see it, Jeff?
I was standing over towards the left. Oswald came out. He had the same look on his face that he always does or has. Suddenly, someone sounded like a loud firecracker rang out. He grabbed his side and he said, "Ow!" and fell to the ground.
And I saw the flash right on his black sweater. The flash. Oh yeah. The man is had a hat. A dark hat, a brown suit. He was stocky and strong. Came to him and he put the gun right there. I saw the flash over the black sweater.
Lee Oswald, disaffected Marine, a strange, bitter, friendless man, was dead. And as in the case of John Wilkes Booth, who was never tried for Lincoln's murder, so here too the legends began to form, and whispers that will never be silenced.
Washington was beautiful in the midday November sunshine as the escort troops, followed by drummers and the caisson bearing the flag-draped coffin, moved along the route from the White House up Pennsylvania Avenue to Capitol Hill. Then, at the foot of the Capitol steps, the traditional presidential salute. And slowly, the casket was carried up the steps into the Capitol Rotunda. and the line began to form. People waiting to pass. The line stretched back 15 blocks, 20, 30. They waited patiently and then filed past, four abreast, all night long, into mid-morning when thousands still waited when the doors were closed.
Monday, and the final scene. The coffin with full military escort from all the armed services retraced the route of the day before, back to the White House as an estimated 1 million persons lined the streets. Then, followed on foot by 220 world leaders, the president's remains were taken to St. Matthew's Cathedral, 8 blocks away. Charles de Gaulle of France, stark, in a uniform without decorations, dominated the groups of foreign leaders. Next to him was Queen Frederica of Greece. Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia was there. King Baudouin of Belgium. 220 of them walking in silent and formless lines to the church.
There is an appointed time for everything, and a time for every affair under the heavens. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to uproot the plant. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away.
Burial was at Arlington Cemetery. On the long slope that reaches out from the Lee Mansion toward Washington and the Lincoln Memorial. And so John Fitzgerald Kennedy, age 46, 35th President of the United States, was laid to rest.
But even in change, there is continuity. 2 days later, the new president went before Congress to spell out his policies and the nation's problems.
We will carry on the fight against poverty and misery and disease and ignorance in other lands and in our own. We will serve all the nation, not one section or one sector or one group, but all America. I urge you again, as I did in 1957, and again in 1960, to enact a civil rights law so that we can move forward to eliminate from this nation every trace of discrimination and oppression that is based upon race or color. And second, no act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year. I pledge that the expenditures of your government will be administered with the utmost thrift and frugality. I will insist that the government get a dollar's value for a dollar spent.
There are dreams in the hearts of all good men, There is a flame that has burned across the centuries and never gone out. A torch that has to be passed from hand to hand. One night, less than a month before his death, John F. Kennedy spoke of his vision of the future.
I look forward to a great future for America. A future in which our country will match its military strength with our moral restraint, its wealth with our wisdom, its power with our purpose. I look forward to an America which will not be afraid of grace and beauty, which will protect the beauty of our natural environment, which will preserve the great old American houses and squares and parks of our national past, and which will build handsome and balanced cities for our future. And I look forward to an America which commands respect throughout the world, not only for its strength, but for its civilization as well. And I look forward to a world which will be safe.
Today, in this moment of new resolve, I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue. This is our challenge. Not to hesitate, not to pause, not to turn about and linger over this evil moment, but to continue on our course so that we may fulfill the destiny that history has set for us.
Well, that was A Time to Keep, 1963, narrated by Chet Huntley and David Brinkley. And I hope everyone enjoyed listening to that. Little story about that album. When I was in the 11th grade American history, I actually used some segments from this album as part of a report that I did on President Kennedy, including the speech that he gave at Berlin. Well, I hope you enjoyed that, and I'll be back next week with another documentary spoken word educational recording. Thanks for listening.